The Ask NT Writes Anything podcast is back.
Hello, this is Tom Wright speaking to you from my study here in Oxford in England. I'm really looking forward to the fact that Mike Bird and I are relaunching the Ask NT Write Anything podcast, looking at key questions that people have sent in, but also developing some themes that he and I have been interested in and we're eager to talk about with one another.
Listen today on your chosen podcast provider and head to asknwrite.com to submit your question.
I think there's something in the water system that is just making us unhealthy. And I don't know exactly what it is, but my story is not uncommon in church leadership.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello and welcome to The Profile. This is Premier Christian Radio and I am Emma Fowle. The Profile is brought to you in association with Premier Christianity, the UK's leading Christian magazine. Head over to premierchristianity.com/podcast for your exclusive half-price subscription offer. Now, today on The Profile, I am joined by Carey Newhoff, author, podcaster, church pastor and leadership expert. After seeing phenomenal growth in the church that he was leading, Carey began to feel called to examine and later share the tools, tips and strategies that he sees as vital for creating healthy church culture. And today he speaks around the world and his leadership resources reach more than 1.5 million people each and every month. In this episode of the podcast, we talk about his own faith journey, the multiple crises facing the church, the pressures that leaders are facing, and why he thinks the current emphasis in Christian circles on spiritual formation may be misplaced.
So, Carey Newhoff, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. We're really, really pleased to have you with us. Carey, if you don't know him, is a broadcaster, an author, he used to be a church leader, and he speaks and writes and talks extensively about church leadership, about change, and about culture and the way that our church, our faith interacts with our culture. So, Carey, it's really, really brilliant to have you with us today. Could you start off, like I ask all our guests, just to give us a little potted history of your own faith history? Did you grow up in a Christian home, or was there a point at which you became a Christian?
Well, thanks for having me, Emma. Yeah, I grew up in a Christian home. My parents were immigrants. They came over from Europe. So I'm first generation Canadian. But we grew up going to church. We went to sort of a Dutch church. That's my parents' background. And it was a little bit more like cultural Christianity, I would say, in the first 10 years. And then we had a big move as a family. And we went to a Presbyterian church up in our new little town just off one of the Great Lakes that was actually pretty evangelical. And my mom and dad had a conversion experience. So I gave my life to Christ probably for the first time when I was like 13 and was very active in the church as a teenager, but then got to my college years and kind of drifted away. I wanted to have just enough faith that if anything happened and I was killed in a car accident, I would still go to heaven, but I wanted to have a lot of fun on earth, if you know what I mean. So I knew I was drifting in the other direction, and at age 21, I'm halfway through my undergrad degree, maybe three quarters of the way through. And I just had an awakening, and I kind of realized I am riding off the coattails of my parents' faith. I'm living off fumes. And I got to get serious about this. I'm either going to be a Christian or I'm going to be an atheist, and I don't know which. So I made a deal with God when I was 21, and I just said, I'm going to read the Bible and pray every day for 6 months, and at the end of it, I'll decide what I'm going to do. And I had still been going to church, like whenever I was home and maybe once a month when I was on my own, but I was like, I was coasting, and that's probably being generous. So I started reading the Bible and praying every day, and it didn't take 6 months. I got completely drawn in. I was convinced that these were the most true words I'd ever read, and I recommitted my life to Christ. So that was around 21, and trying to do a long obedience in the same direction. That was a while ago.
That's so interesting. My faith story is similar. I didn't grow up in a Christian home, but I became a Christian as a young teenager. But also, university years are pretty testing on one's faith, aren't they?
It is, you know, they say a lot of young adults would become Christian if it wasn't for the lifestyle, quote, requirements. And we don't believe they're requirements. We believe they're a response. But I think I was probably in that camp. I was having too much fun, or what I thought was fun. And intellectually, you know, I had questions, but when I did my like little experiment, Christianity more than stood up to the intellectual objections that I had. And when I wasn't expecting to go into ministry, I was just going to be a Christian. I was heading to law school, like that was my plan. But I think after I became a pastor, it gave me a great deal of empathy and understanding for people who had intellectual questions, who had lifestyle questions, and who were sort of on the outside of faith looking in. And so, yeah, I think God used it. And ultimately, you know, if you don't throw it out, it makes you stronger, right? If you question it, but you embrace it in the end, I think you become a stronger Christian. And certainly my faith has grown, obviously, over the last few decades. But it went in as my faith, not something that I inherited or was given to me or that I, quote, absorbed, you know, just by growing up as a church kid.
And so you were headed for law school and you actually became a lawyer for a while.
Yes. Yeah.
At what point did you decide that actually that wasn't the career for you? And why and how did you move into church ministry?
I don't know that I even made a decision. It's a great way to phrase the question. So I know you have probably a lot of charismatic listeners. I was Presbyterian at the time. So if you look at opposite for charismatic, it's probably Presbyterian. All right. So I didn't necessarily not believe that God spoke, but I didn't feel like I heard from God on a regular basis or anything like that. But it was in first year law, when I finished that law school, I worked at a firm in the summer, and in August of that year had a supernatural experience. It was like almost an out-of-body experience where I saw my life. It was like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It feels like something out of the book of Acts. And I had this vision of me 20 years in the future. So I was 24 at the time when I had the vision. So I saw myself at 44, wildly successful. This is all in my mind's eye. I'm wide awake. See myself wildly successful in law and morally bankrupt. Families in shambles, marriages in shambles, my ethics are ruined. And it's just like a daydream. And I just knew in an instant, I knew in my spirit, okay, law is not for me. This is not for me. But I didn't know what to do. And I was at a law firm in my hometown, and I went into the firm library. They had a nice bay window, and I'm staring out the bay window, and down the road, I can see the church I grew up in. And I felt this call, this voice, not audible, but almost audible, that said, you should be in there. And the part of the church that I could see was the pastor's study. Like, I knew the church like at the back of my hand. And I'm like, in there? Are you kidding me? Like, no. And so it was toward the end of the day. I was completely confused and disoriented after that. And I went to pick up my fiance, soon-to-be wife, who was working down the road. And we went to my parents' place for dinner. And we had known each other for a year. We met in law school. And we'd never talked about ministry, ever. And I picked her up. I didn't say a word about what had happened to me a couple hours earlier. And as we're driving to my parents' house, she just looks at me and goes, "You ever think of going into ministry?" I'm like, "What? What?" Like, out of the blue, out of the blue. And that began several years of discernment. I finished law. I worked for a year in downtown Toronto in law. But years of discernment and multiple confirmations that, yeah, this probably was the path for me. But yeah, that was sort of my story. So unusual as a Presbyterian, right, to get that kind of a revelation.
Well, sometimes God needs to make it really super plain to us, doesn't he?
Well, I think it was C.S. Lewis who says that's basically for the spiritually immature. So that would be me, right? Like, silence is a mark of maturity. And God's like, well, if I'm silent with him, he's never going to hear from me. So yeah, definitely it was. I don't know how else God would have gotten my attention.
And how was it moving into ministry? You know, I often think that being a vicar or a church leader or a pastor, yeah, is one of those careers that it actually brings a lot to the table if you've had an industry career beforehand. It isn't something you've just done since you were a young man. But also it's a very different environment and a very different culture. So how did you find it moving from one to the other?
Well, it was interesting. You'd think a lot of the skills would translate, and they kind of do, but they really don't, right? Like, so I worked in downtown Toronto, and one of the reasons I did that 1 year in law is I thought I knew too many pastors who had gone to school and started immediately at a church and didn't know what it was like to earn a paycheck. And I'm like, I'm going to be dealing with people every day who are just out there in the world trying to make a paycheck. Working in secular companies, I have to have some understanding. So I'm like, I want to work for at least a year. So I did. So I came in with that, and I think that was a really good bridge. I think about that year in law a lot. Like, it was only 12 months, but my goodness, I learned so much in that sphere. But yeah, when I got to church, that was another thing. You know, again, the revelations continued. I thought, okay, I know how I'm cut. I'm a city boy, you know, lawyer. I should be in a downtown Toronto church that ministers to professionals because, you know, the church is very good at embracing the poor, the marginalized, the sick, the hurting. Who's talking to the people in the bank towers? Who's talking to the people at the law firms? I'm like, I know how to do that. I'm putting my hand up. And I had an opportunity to be at a church that basically had that ministry. They were in a nice neighborhood and everybody would vacate the downtown core, come to, well, it was still midtown. But, you know, it was a very nice neighborhood, and I thought, I know how to do this. A little bit like HTB, right? Like that kind of neighborhood. I'm like, wait, I'm good at this. And they offered me a job, but before I had a job there, we had an opportunity to interview at a church, three little tiny rural churches north of Toronto, about an hour north of Toronto. And I mean, surrounded by farmland, exactly the opposite of what I would have had in Toronto. And that had started, like I had done that job interview process and then happened to mention it to the Toronto church, and they're like, wait a minute, here's an offer. And I thought, okay, well, if that church north of Toronto, if they just decide to go in another direction, then the decision's made for me. They didn't. They called me, that those churches north of Toronto called me, and they said, we are calling you as our pastor. And I'm like, uh-oh, I have two opportunities now. I don't know what to do. And so I said, listen, I'm going to have to get back to you. And my wife and I were married by this time. And I just said, oh my goodness, they want to call me too. Now what do we do? And she said to me, well, why don't we just open the Bible and see what God has to say? And, you know, the arrogant seminarian is like, that's not how the Bible works. You don't just open it and God tells you in the page. And she said, what would the Apostle Paul do? And my Bible opened to Acts 16. And it was Paul trying to decide where to go. And he ended up going to Macedonia. He had all these other factors. And the one thing I knew, because I was already in seminary at the time, was that Macedonia was poor. So there's a rich church in Toronto, some poor churches north of Toronto. And Paul was convinced he had to go and help them. And the person who called me from the churches north of Toronto said, why don't you just come on to Oro and help us? And the Apostle Paul has this vision of a man from Macedonia who says, why don't you just come to Macedonia and help us? Like almost verbatim. And I'm like, I think I know where we're going. And so we've been an hour north of Toronto. Those little churches are about 10 minutes from where I am right now for the last 30 years. And God called us there. But all those skills, like basically, I have to talk to farmers and rural people who have been in this community for a long time, and the churches were tiny, and I didn't understand anything about ministry. So I just, if that's a long way to answer your question, but I just sat down with the elders and the leadership team when I got here, and I just said, look, I'm a lawyer. I don't know how to lead a church. And with all due respect, it's not going particularly well for you guys. You've been stagnant for 40 years. Why don't we roll up our sleeves and see if we can figure this out together? And God has been very gracious. And, you know, we're a multi-site church that now reaches thousands of people. And we're really thankful for that. But that's how it started.
And now you spend your time, or a larger portion of your time, as well as being involved in that church, in actually bringing some of that skills and experience and to other church leaders and to other Christians around the world. And you write a lot about change, about leadership, about culture, about healthy church culture. what point did you think, oh, do you know what, I've got something to offer outside of my church here? And how did that unfold for you?
Yeah, I don't know that I ever thought that I did, but I'll tell you how it happened is those little churches north of Toronto, we started to grow. And within 5 years, had sold our original historic 19th century buildings and moved into an elementary school and then built a new state-of-the-art facility. So while that was happening, I started getting questions because, you know, like the church in England, the church in Canada is not particularly healthy. There's not a lot of growing churches. And in the denomination that I was a part of at the time, most of the churches were declining and very small. So we had more and more phone calls, questions, messages from people going, how is this happening? So I started to teach just at regional governance things for our denomination. And then we did a conference. And then I got connected with some U.S. church leaders and they started inviting me. So it sort of happened just by the grace of God. I just kept getting invited to go and tell our story. And then I also realized, you know, I went to law school, but nobody taught me how to run a law firm. And I went to seminary, and nobody taught me how to run a church. And I had to figure all this stuff out in real time. So, 15 years ago or so, I just started a blog. And I needed a hobby, and I'm like, I'm just going to help church leaders try to figure out all the stuff that they didn't learn in seminary that I had to learn the hard way. Like, if this took me 5 years to figure it out, maybe you can do it in 5 months or, you know, 5 minutes in some cases. So, yeah, that's what I've been doing. And then in 2015, I stepped back as a lead pastor of our church and did a teaching role for a few years, but just thought it was time for succession. And have been doing this full time now for almost a decade and just love it. Just love it.
So let's talk about some of those issues, because this is what you spend a lot of your time thinking about and writing about. So I'd love to get some of your wisdom on some of these issues. You've just started a new podcast series called Pastoring in a Partisan Age, and you've had various speakers on talking about what it is like to be part of church leadership in an age where, you know, some might say we're more divided than we've ever been before. There's a lot of political division. There's a lot of moral outrage. There's a lot of criticism being hurled around, especially on the internet. What does the church have to say to these issues? What is it that you're hoping that you can impart as you unpack some of this stuff?
Well, yeah, this series could be the enemy. I mean, who knows? We're in the middle of it right now. You know, to be honest with you, Emma, My inclination is to put my head in the sand and just ignore it and come up for air in December or January when the election in the U.S. is over. And it's like, all right, we're out of this now. But I realized that that wasn't a very good approach. And I talked to some, you know, most of my audience is American. So I talked to a lot of American leaders and they felt the same way. And I also talked to enough pastors to know that so many got burned in 2020 during the election, in 2016 during the election. And the culture right now in the United States is, and I'm sure there's traces of this in England, there's traces of this in Canada, where no matter what you do, you're in trouble. If you speak out, you spoke out the wrong way or on the wrong side of an issue, or you were too vitriolic or not vitriolic enough, or you were too partisan or not partisan enough, or by your silence, you should have said something, but you said something, but you didn't say the right thing, or you said it in the wrong tone. I mean, it's almost a no-win proposition right now. And I thought, okay, we have to get to the bottom of this. So I just thought, who are some of the wisest people I know on this subject? And maybe I could have conversations with them. So N.T. Wright agreed to come on the podcast, which was so great. Ed Stetzer, Andy Stanley, Sharon McMahon, Mark Sayers. I mean, many friends, I'm sure, of Premier Christianity. A guy named Michael Ware from the United States. And what was really interesting about that is they all pointed to the fact that the election is an issue, but it's not the real issue. That we're in a cultural moment where so much of the division and the partisanship through technology, through becoming a secular culture, the culture wars that are happening. So what we really do is, yeah, we touch on the election, but we're really exploring the issues under the issues. Why is conflict so inflamed? I'll give you a couple of quick reasons, just really, you know, the Cole's Notes version, Cliff Notes version of it. So one is, my theory, 95% of the conflict in the church has nothing to do with the church. that when you get that angry email, or when you, you know, as a radio podcaster, get that angry listener who's like, I can't believe you had so-and-so on. If you really drill down, that's almost never the issue. I have a privilege. I do a podcast as well. So I interviewed one of the top negotiators in the world alive today, William Ury. He did everything from Middle East peace to de-escalating nuclear conflict to corporate negotiation, and is widely respected as the world's probable leading authority. And I ran that theory by him, and he's like, 100% true. That often the issue that presents, think about a marriage, right? Where, well, why didn't you empty the dishwasher? That's not about the dishwasher. That's about all the other things that went unaddressed over the years that have caused it to erupt on the presenting issue. That's what's happening in culture. So one of the things you can do as a leader, you know, if you were to call an angry listener to the show and just say, hi, it's Emma from Premier Christianity, got your email. First of all, they're completely disarmed. They're like, oh my goodness, I can't believe you call me. And then secondly, you find out that their marriage is in trouble, or that they've got a daughter or a son who's sort of going off in the opposite direction and they're not very happy about that, or their job's under threat at work, or they've got too much debt. And you realize that when you carry that level of stress and you carry that level of difficulty, you tend to lash out at easy targets. And the church is an easy target. A radio host is an easy target. A podcaster is an easy target. Somebody that you don't really know online is an easy target. So I think that's there. Another thing is with the, our belief has become our identity. So with really our culture becoming more and more secular, God created us to have our identity secure in something. It's supposed to root in Christ. I think a lot of your listeners would agree with that, but it doesn't. And it doesn't always even in the church. And so what do people attach their identity to? We attach our identity to our children. And as Tim Keller said, you know, an idol is anything that you can't imagine your life without. I couldn't imagine if I didn't have my kids. I couldn't imagine if I didn't have money. I couldn't imagine if I didn't have listeners. I couldn't imagine if I didn't have this job, right? So we put our identity in all these false places. And one of the things that's really happened in the last 20 or 30 years is we put our identity in our belief and our viewpoint. So if you're attacking my ideas, you're attacking me. And now I got to fight you. And that's true with conspiracy theories. That's true with all of the craziness that we see in the culture. So what I really wanted to help leaders see is that there are issues under the issues, and I'm learning this in real time too as we do these interviews, and that if you address the issues under the issues, you're going to diffuse the conflict in your church. Because if you're just debating about whether the world is flat or the world is round, or you're debating about who should win the election, or you're debating about which party, you know, you've had so many prime ministers in England in the last 5 years, it's hard to keep track. I told people, I've lost count. I can't keep up anymore. But if you're debating that kind of stuff, you're just going to have a fight. And if you really get to the issue under the issue, you find a common humanity, perhaps a common faith, and you are united around that. So that's what we're diving into, plus the culture wars and conspiracy theories and all of that.
Yeah, it's really interesting you saying it's tempting to bury your head in the sand until the elections are over. But I think if there's one thing we've learned probably over the last 4 or 5 years, really, is that you're right. Those issues don't go away. They just manifest themselves in another way.
Well,
don't they? We've been through all of the same here with Brexit and our many elections and leaders stepping down, et cetera, et cetera. So we have to find a way, don't we, to have conversations that deal with these issues in a way that is helpful and healthy.
One of my guests is on the podcast series is Sharon McMahon, and she makes a really good point. She says the majority is exhausted. It's exhausted. Hate has been monetized. Believe it or not, I mean, you know this, extreme views drive traffic. If you want to get a great rating on this episode, make me say something outrageous and then have a crazy headline. You know, you won't believe what Carrie Newhoff said. Not that anybody would follow what I said, but you know what I mean? Like, that's how to get traffic. And there are literally billions of dollars being made on hate right now in the commercial economy. And it's being funded by people. This isn't a conspiracy theory, but if you want to make money, be inflammatory. And what happens in this environment that we're in when that is the case is the reasonable majority, most of us are in the middle. You know, we're a little bit right, a little bit left, whatever. But most of us aren't extreme. we're exhausted and we leave the building. We put our heads in the sand. We're like, I'm not even going to present, you know, pretend that this exists. And the reality is the gospel is political, as N.T. Wright would say, but it's not political in the way we think. It's not political in the partisan way. It does have something to say about the poor and the downtrodden and the brokenhearted and a vision for culture that is different than what we experience. So it has political implications, but it's not political that way. And what happens is the good people disappear. The good people say, I would have to be crazy to step into the public policy arena right now. I'd have to be crazy to run for office. I'd have to be insane to try to enter this debate. So yeah, I think that's a real problem. And what we need is more good, moderate people in the discussion to try to normalize it a little bit and stabilize it a little bit and bring it back to a common sense place.
And do you think it also adds pressure on church leaders? I mean, perhaps more so in North America than here. We don't particularly have a church culture of speaking about politics from the pulpit, but I know in the States that's much more common. How should church leaders approach the issue of politics?
It's a great question, because I think we went through a period, I think it's abating a little bit right now, where everybody had to have a position on everything. In other words, you needed a position on the Middle East. You need a position on what you think about this social issue, that social issue. And you could see we went through a period from 2020 to 2022 where even for-profit companies were issuing statements on everything. This is what we believe about the Supreme Court decision. This is what we believe. And there's a certain point, it's like, wait a minute, you make shoes. Like, why do you have an opinion on this issue, right? And pastors got forced into that situation where it's like, well, what are we doing about X? And what is your position on Y? And the reality is we're trained in theology. We're not experts on politics. We're not experts on every single social issue. But because of the media culture we're in, you know, people hear about things and they think our church should be doing something, saying something. So I think that's abated a little bit over the last 12 to 18 months, and I think that's probably good. I think there are definitely issues we need to speak up on. They're probably few and far between, but we do need to say some things, and we need to really focus on a kingdom viewpoint for the world. Like, what does it look like to actually be Christians? And I think the more we focus on what I call the alt kingdom, which is the kingdom of God, the kingdom that Jesus ushered in, which is not of this world, but transcends the world. And as N.T. Wright would say, has very much implications for this world. Dallas Willard would agree with him. If we focus on that and ushering in that kingdom, we're going to be a lot better. And what that does is it gives people a third narrative. It's not left or right. It's not this extreme view or that extreme view. It's like, oh, my kingdom is not of this world. You know, as Jesus said, among you, it will be different. And I think among us as Christians, it has to be different. We have to find that other narrative. And because we've been so hijacked, our attention has been so hijacked by the cultural narrative right now, we could do better to focus more on the biblical narrative and to dive deeper into kingdom. And if we begin to bring that to the surface, we now have an alternate vision that we can present to people and they can start to live by, because the kingdom has significant implications for everyday life.
Hi, I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity, the UK's leading Christian magazine. Every month, our team brings you deep, thoughtful journalism around the biggest topics affecting you as a Christian today. Our mission is to help you encounter God through the magazine. The latest issue features Switchfoot lead singer John Foreman, plus we're previewing the largest gathering of Christians ever. Find out more in the latest issue of Premier Christianity magazine.
A lot of that division, you could probably say, has at least not been helped by the advent of social media and technology and online content, which can be very divisive, clickbaity, lots of shouting from behind a screen and not sort of, you know, good real life dialogue. And when you were over in the UK back in May and speaking at the leadership conference, you were speaking about the changes in the way that pressures are perceived by older and younger leaders in the church, and marrying that somehow to what it's like to grow up in a digital age. But at the same time, there is this pressure, isn't there, for churches to very much engage and make the use of technology. And again, you've written about that, that how does the church actually drive forward into 2024 and really utilise technology and use it for good? So we're kind of stuck in this world of tension, aren't we? Oh, the internet is bad and it does some bad things, but actually we need to be engaging in this space because we can't bury our heads in the sand from it. How does the church do it well?
Well, you know, let's go back to first principles. So like most things, all things that are not Christ, social media makes a terrible master and a wonderful servant. And I think the problem is a lot of us have made it our master. We're on our phones a ridiculous amount of time a day. We are consuming news. There was a wonderful book written decades ago by Neil Postman called Amusing Ourselves to Death. And he wrote that maybe in the late 80s, early 90s. And he was deeply concerned. All we had was broadcast television at the time. And he's basically saying our attention spans are getting smaller. We're debating on issues that really we shouldn't have an opinion on. And he talked about the arrival of the telegraph in North America in the mid-19th century. And he uses the example, you know, because everyone was interested in the king or queen of England. But, you know, somebody in Kansas would just be going about their farming and going about their everyday life. But suddenly with the arrival of the telegraph, you learn that some prince in England has a cold. And suddenly that becomes the talk of the town. It's like, well, what relevance? Like, are you ever going to meet that prince? Are you ever going to, like, you probably want to know that the king or queen has died or that there's been a coronation. But do you really need to know the comings and the goings? And of course, you know, he didn't even have Charles and Diana at that time to pick on. They hadn't broken up yet. So, I mean, the amount of completely useless information that we process every day is insane. And Jonathan Haidt is doing really good work right now on exposing what that is doing to Gen Z brains and to soon Generation Alpha brains. Like it is putting our anxiety off the charts. And if you look back at it, here's a great opportunity for the church to speak into this. You know, we can go right back to the Garden of Eden, and there we have the knowledge of the tree of good and evil. And so we've bitten the apple, and so now we don't have the knowledge of God, but we have way more knowledge than we were ever designed to be able to sustain. British evolutionary psychologist Robin Dunbar, there's his name, Robin Dunbar, says that basically for most of human history, we've lived in communities of 200 or fewer people, little villages around England and so on in Europe, and even in America and Canada, it was small towns. The cities are a relatively rare and unusual phenomena. And he says, basically, 200 people, you can deal with 200 people, right? Like, you kind of know, oh, that's the blacksmith, this is the copper, the cooper, this is the so-and-so. And you kind of know, and you've got to have your standing in the village, but that's like a scalable thing. And now we have 20,000 people that we follow, or 2,000 people who follow us. And it's impossible, and it breaks down. And God didn't actually design us for that kind of knowledge. So we have this curse of knowledge. We have the knowledge of God, part of it, without the wisdom of God. So what do we do with that? Well, pick better channels. Secondly, I think we have to, I'm getting ready to interview on my podcast an ex-Facebook executive, and I'm going to talk to her about unintended consequences. Like Mark Zuckerberg did not anticipate in 2004 that social media was going to have this kind of traumatic impact on the next generation. So we have to be thinking through, what are the unintended consequences? We have to be thinking through, how do we use it responsibly? How do we not get into clickbait? How do we not get into polarization? How do we make sure that we're actually serving people? So I have an unofficial model. We have a tiny team on our company, but I have a lot of help in doing what I do. And we talk about it this way, and it's been very helpful for us. We frame it as, we want to be a place for the good people to gather on the internet. And I love that. It's like, you know, there are good people. They just want helpful information. They don't need all the hype. They don't need all of that. And we want to be, and they're going to leave reasonable comments, and they're going to be like reasonable people. I think you want that to be your church. I think you want that to be your social media. This is a place where the good people can gather. And then the other thing that's becoming increasingly important, I think, is to teach people good digital hygiene. Where do you get your news from? If you're reading it from the extreme side here or there, read the other side as well. Or better yet, find some more reliable, truthful sources along the way, and then try to model that in how you do your social media by being, you know, one of the things we say in you know, what I do is trust is my brand. I never want to violate trust. I always want to be, you know, the person that people, if you met me in real life, it's the same on the internet. So there's no gap. And the other thing is we want to be helpful. Did this help somebody? Is it going to make a difference in their lives? So I think those are some reasonable filters for the use of social media.
So that sounds like very wise advice. Is that hard won advice? Have you ever got yourself into a space where it's got out of kilter for you? I mean, obviously you're a person whose brand probably relies quite a lot on the internet, and that's, you know, arguably without the technology we have now, it would be much harder to earn your living from blogging, writing, speaking, podcasting. I'm in a similar space as a journalist myself. Has there ever been a time when you've struggled to get the balance right?
Oh yeah, all the time. And you know, there were times where we had comments on my blog when blogging was a thing. We still blog, but it's totally different today than it was even 5 years ago, 10 years ago. And I would get into the comments and I would try to explain, you know, what was going on. And I don't know about you, Emma, that never goes well. Like if somebody is just out and they're upset and they're frustrated, you can't reason with that person. So I had to give up on that. There are subjects that honestly should have been for a smaller audience. Here's one. If you want to get some mail for this podcast, this radio broadcast, try this. Should pastors have disclosure about who gives what? So I teach church leaders right into the nitty gritty on that stuff. And I've lived without it. And I've also had it. I think it's better for pastors to have it or have a form of it. So I did a reel on Instagram last year where, you know, it's 60 seconds. What nuance can you give in 60 seconds on a reel? Very, very little nuance. And I had taught this in a course, but a course is totally different. If I've got you for a day, we can go back and forth. We can debate it. We can discuss it. And I can go, oh, that's a really good point. Anyway, I put a 60-second reel up. And people, you know, the first 100 comments were very polite and nuanced. Not everybody agreed with me, but it was a reasonable debate. Well, then the algorithm goes, oh, this video is getting traction, and it throws it out there into the wider internet. And oh my goodness, the people who found it after that, I was the worst person in human history. And there's a certain point at which, what are you going to do? I mean, you can't defend yourself. You can't fight back. So you just let the trolls do their troll thing. You block the really horrible stuff. And you just go, all right, that's probably more for like a nuanced discussion when we can have a nuanced discussion. And I'm probably not going to throw that out there again. Yeah. And then, you know, you also have this, we have this every time I have certain guests on my show. And I'm, you know, I definitely have personal convictions and beliefs, but, you know, I'll have a guest that I disagree with. And there are some guests that the internet just loves to pick on. And so we'll get a series of emails if I profile a guest on my podcast. I can't believe that you had so-and-so on your podcast. And if you have so-and-so, that means you're just like him and I'm going to have to cancel you. And all right, I don't know what to do with that. So I called one guy last week when this happened and we had a really reasonable conversation. I still don't think I changed his mind, but you know, it's just one of those things. You're guilty for what you do. You're guilty for what you don't do. And I think, you know, for me, it's like, hey, I want to be helping. I want to move in a long obedience in the same direction. I think over time, the truth is the best defense. No, I'm, you know, I make mistakes like everybody else, but this is basically what I'm about. You have your integrity. You don't sell it out. And I think long-term, that's still going to win. I'm hopeful that that's still going to win. I'm believing that that's still going to win. I think it will. I've been at this for a while. It seems to be going okay. But I mean, you just want to be one of the hopefully good people on the internet. Not that we're not all sinners and fallen short of the glory. Yep, I have. But you want to be good people. And so just be a good person, be a good human, you know, treat the person online the way you would treat your next door neighbor or your best friend, and you'll be okay.
And are there any topics to do with church leadership and things like that that you just would not touch with a barge pole? That you're like, no, I'm just not going to go there.
LGBTQ is really difficult right now. And I'm not saying it's a subject that doesn't need speaking into, but there's also, and you know, it's so nuanced and it's so challenging right now. And I don't feel that's my primary mission. Like, that's not my ministry. I don't have an LGBTQ plus ministry. But whatever you say, on whatever side, you just draw out so many polarized people. Abortion is another issue like that. Politics was almost an issue. But I'm like, this is so deep and so pervasive, the partisan era that we're in. I really want to tackle it. So that's why I did the podcast series. But if you're into a culture war issue, I think you have to be very careful about, you know, do you want to go 72 rounds with this? And do you have enough? Like, I'll give you an example of a non-controversial subject. But discipleship is a buzzword in the church right now. And I have my own theory about that. Because I think we're losing at evangelism. Everybody's focused on discipleship. Maybe that's a little bit of a cynical take. But, you know, I have had multiple offers, like, we want you to do a course on discipleship. And I'm just like, look, I believe in discipleship. I know it's biblical. I'm trying to be a disciple. I don't have a lot of content on that. Thank you for the offer. Thank you for the money you offered me. I'm turning it down because... go talk to John Mark Comer. Like, he's really good at that stuff. Like, you know, like, you have to stick in your lane. And so I have a pretty narrow lane. You mentioned it a couple times, you know, it's leadership, change, personal growth. And then if I want to become an expert at something, like I really wanted to dive into LGBTQ, or I really wanted to dive into some other issues that are hot button issues right now, I would, but I don't feel like that's my calling. I think there's a lot of other voices who are probably going to contribute a lot more on any side on those issues. So I have those things that I feel really compelled to. Like, I'm working on a long-term project right now about getting a healthier church, developing a non-toxic church. What do we do to make sure that our churches stay healthier? That, I feel like I led a church for 20 years. I was unhealthy for a number of those years. I know what that feels like. I know what it feels like to lead healthy. I know what it feels like to not be healthy and lead. I have asked a million questions on that to so many leaders, and I want to do some research. Now, there's a lane that I think I'm comfortable in, and we can talk all day long privately and publicly about that. But there's some that I just think it's a fool's errand.
So what did that look like for you? You referenced just then that you were definitely in a position where you were leading unhealthily for a while. What did that look like for you?
So for us, it was a very rapid growth in the first decade. And I was in my 30s. I started ministry when I was 30 years old. And, you know, it wasn't headline-grabbing stuff. I didn't have an affair, didn't do anything stupid, anything like that. But my wife and I, we had tension in our marriage. A lot of couples do once you're a decade into it. So, and that was me needing to grow emotionally, to get in touch with some of the stuff. And this is an area that I am very interested in developing further is, you know, look at the drive it takes to be a leader. What is really driving that drive? Are your motivations actually healthy? And Gordon MacDonald, in his book from decades ago, says that he has a whole chapter in Ordering Your Private World about the difference between being called and being driven. And I was a driven leader and had to prove myself, you know, I was a performance addict. So, and you know, when you're on a stage and every single week there's more people in the room than there was the week before, you need a massive amount of character to be able to handle that. And I didn't have the character developed to the point in my 30s where I could handle that. And so there was a hole inside of me that God was able to fill through prayer and counseling and lots of help and lots of friends and that kind of stuff. But it was a pretty big hole in my 30s. And no matter how well our church did or how well I did as a preacher, I wanted to do better. There was no finish line. There was no contentment. So what that meant is that I probably went through staff faster than I had to go through staff because nobody was good enough and nobody was fast enough. It meant that that put pressure on my marriage. And God was very merciful. When I was 41, I burned out. and it was sudden. I'd been tired for a few years, but you know, probably the unhealth got really intense in my late 30s. So for about 2 or 3 years, it was just, I wasn't happy. You know, there was tension. And again, it wasn't like reporter comes in, there's nothing there. Like it's not terrible. It's not headline worthy, but it's just not healthy. It's not good. And people got hurt. And I had just come off of the biggest speaking engagement I'd ever done, 2,500 people in Atlanta. Apparently it was great. And I got back on the plane to Toronto. And when we landed, I just collapsed. I fell off a cliff. And I basically was under house arrest by God for the summer of 2006. And really had the energy to get up in the morning, but that was about it. My passion was gone. My hope was gone. I burned out. And it took me a few months, but I kind of got back to functioning. And I just became determined in that season to never go back to where I was before. And to really, you know, to ask the question from John 5, do you want to get well? For the first time in my life, I'm like, I want to get well. And, you know, this is a caution to leaders, Emma. But one of the biggest challenges I had when I went for therapy, when I went for counseling, is they started to probe at all the stuff that was making me, quote, successful. All right. And I'm like, oh, if you deal with that, I'm going to lose my secret sauce. Like we're going to have a declining church, not a growing church. And I was really afraid of it. And I've talked to a lot of leaders. They're very afraid of getting healthy. And the reason they're afraid of getting healthy is it's going to take that edge away, that magic away, that, you know, je ne sais quoi. And so I just really had no choice. And I've spent the last 18 years of my life trying to get healthier every day, trying to not hurt the people closest to me, trying to deal with better ways of being relationally healthy and emotionally healthy and spiritually healthy, physically healthy and mentally healthy. And it's been so much better because I think the old path was the people closest to me didn't have a great experience of me, but somebody in the back row thought I was awesome, or some leader in California thought I was great. And now it doesn't really matter what the people in the back row think or someone in California thinks. If my wife and I are good, if my kids and I are good, if my team and I and my inner circle, those 40 or 50 people that I see every day, I want them to have the best experience of me, not the worst, not the leftovers, not the fumes. And so that's the difference between now and then. And when I look out at the wider church, which is why I'm so interested in this subject, I think there's something in the water system that is just making us unhealthy. And I don't know exactly what it is, but my story is not uncommon in church leadership or in leadership period. I saw it in law all the time too for the year I was there. But what is it that we can do that would make it better and not make those unintended consequences? Because we're all doing this. In my 30s, I was very committed to Jesus. And I was doing it in the name of Jesus, but I wasn't doing it right. And so I've had to work through that. I've had a few conversations with leaders, and drugs isn't a part of my story. I don't know what it feels like to be high, but some leaders describe it as a drug. I mean, when you get up there and the crowd is there, I was talking to a comedian, very well-known comedian in the U.S., John Crist, in Christian circles, and he got canceled in 2019 and had some issues he had to really deal with in his life, but we had a pretty transparent conversation, and he's like, you know, the laughs that people get, that recognition that he gets when he gets stopped at an airport, stopped at a Chick-fil-A, he says, it's like a drug. And, you know, I agree. When you see your podcast numbers going up, it's very intoxicating. It releases chemicals in the brain, which I guess are God-given, but it's not the right, like, you know, what did Tim Keller say? I'm always quoting Tim Keller these days. If success goes to your head, failure will go to your heart. And I think that's very, very true, right? Because sometimes podcast numbers go down, or sometimes, you know, the crowd's a little bit smaller, or not everybody showed up. And so what I'm really trying to do, and what I think, you know, and I again, I'm going to do more research on this, but I don't want to be too swayed. You know, the numbers have to inform you, but they can't define you, as Carl Vader says. I think that's really, really important. And for a long time, they defined me. It got so bad in my early 30s that I thought, if the church declined for more than 3 months, I'm going to resign because clearly I'm a terrible leader. Yeah, like wow. What's wrong with your head, right? To think that thought. I don't think I said it out loud, but that's what I believed. And I don't believe it anymore. But, I mean, it's crazy.
And was that a pressure that was put on you from the outside, or was that all just you?
100% self-generated. Mm-hmm. No, that's me. That's me in my messed up little universe. That's me putting pressure on myself. There was nobody in our church who put that pressure on me, no elder or anything like that. But here's the thing, Emma, you can create a culture where that pressure is both internal and external. If you start appointing leaders or selecting leaders who have that or have a better drive, you can get into warp speed where they enable you. And, you know, the burnout that I experienced in 2006 was so painful. But looking back on it now, it took me a decade to get there. But after a decade, I realized, wait a minute, that wasn't pain. That was a gift. Like, that was probably the gentlest possible landing you could have had, because what was around the corner in a year or two was way worse than that if you had kept going down that path. So, yeah, it was just one of those things where I was amazed to see that God was kind enough to stop me in my tracks. And yeah, it's been a different 18 years. Not a perfect 18 years, but fundamentally different.
So let's talk a little bit about how we do it better. So if those are the pressures, and if naturally, let's face it, the people that tend to rise to the top, whether it is in church or in business, are those types of character. They're strong leaders, they're energetic, they're driven, they're visionary, they're brilliant communicators, they're probably charismatic. You know, those are the people that as humans we're drawn to, and we tend to sort of elevate, and we stick them out the front and say, you run the church. But also the shadow side of those characters are that they are likely to be people who may be susceptible to all of those things. What do? Do we put all pastors through a series of intense counseling before we appoint them? What's the trick?
That's a great question, and one that I'm actively researching and trying to figure out. So I'll give you a couple of very tentative conclusions. Number one is therapy. I don't know why therapy is so big these days. It is maybe because we've lost that close-knit community where we just kind of process it. The other thing I would say too is people living in villages of 200 didn't have the responsibility most leaders have today. Just didn't. I mean, basically, your capacity was how many loaves of bread can I bake? How many shoes can I fix? How many, you know, horses can I make shoes for, et cetera, et cetera. That was your capacity. And now we're charged with leading 500, 1,000, 1,500, 3,000 people. You know, my podcast has tens of millions of downloads. It's like, what? Were we designed for this? So I think therapy is really helpful. It's been very, and the other thing that really comes to mind is community. You need people who are not impressed with you. You need people who have known you before you became who you, quote, are today. And you need people, you know, the other thing that's really good, Arthur Brooks wrote a great book a few years ago called From Strength to Strength. He's got a very small section that I cannot get out of my head, but the difference between real friends and deal friends. And most of our friends, like, think about your career in broadcasting, right? You have a lot of friends. If you quit tomorrow, you'd be shocked at how your phone gets quiet really quickly. And I have friends who stepped out of leading mega churches. Just, it was their season. They were done. No scandal or anything. They just stopped. And they're like, my phone is dead. What is going on? What's happening? And those were all deal friends. They were part of the deal. And I'm reminding myself now, I have a great podcast. I'm fortunate to do what I do. I speak all over the world. I write books. Man, 98% of that is going away. It is. Because when I can't be useful to a lot of other people, those are all deal friends. And I love my deal friends. They're great. But they rely on me to do something for them. So the alternative to deal friends is real friends. And most leaders have no real friends. Again, Robin Dunbar says you can have 3 to 5. That's all you need. But most have 0. I used to ask the staff when I led a church, if we stopped ministry today, what would be left of your faith? Mm. That's a great question. I mean, I'm still a Christian, but I'm not preaching. I'm teaching. There's a difference. My faith is robust, and it's gone through peaks and valleys like everybody else's, but there was something left over. Like, I'm a child of God, I'm loved, and I will be loved when I don't contribute anything anymore, or when, you know, I don't get any invitations to speak, or nobody wants to come on my podcast. I'll still be a loved child of God. I'm really building into my marriage right now. The best offense, I think, or best defense is a great offense. So, you know, I want to have a rich marriage. I don't want to just, you know, affair proof my marriage by putting up all these boundaries. I've got boundaries. I want to make it so rich in the middle that in what universe is this a good idea to stray outside of this, right? Like, that's the stuff that I'm working on.
Yeah.
I don't know. What do you hear in that? What do you think?
Oh, I think there's so much gold, isn't there? And there's so much to wrestle with. And there's so much wisdom that we can learn from culture and from business. But I'm also aware that there's a lot of people who sort of approach this type of stuff, who might go on your website, read your blog, who'd be like, I don't get this. Like, you know, that sort of, the church is not a business. Why are we talking about like leadership?
Oh yeah, I get that all the time. Yeah.
So what would be your comeback for that? How would you address those concerns?
When you have to make decisions, like, I agree, if you're in a church of 50 people, you're in a pastoral model that has lasted for centuries, and that's great. You don't need a lot of that corporate experience. But when our church broke the 1,000 attendance barrier, and by the time I left, it was 3,000 to 4,000 people, you're just dealing with organizational complexity that is complicated. And you're not a CEO, you're still a shepherd, you're still a pastor. But if you don't know how to manage teams, if you don't know how to read a profit and loss statement and make sure your finances are okay, and if you don't know how to hire properly or to let people go when you're supposed to let them go, if you don't know how to do that, you're dead in the water. And seminary doesn't train you for that. They don't teach you how to have a healthy relationship with your elders, with your board. They don't teach you, at least they didn't when I went through it, all of these things. So, you know, I have empathy for that. And you don't want someone to behave exclusively like a CEO who's maximizing shareholder value and doing a quarterly earnings call. No. But there's a lot.
That's brilliant.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.
The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.